From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells. And our next guest is psychiatrist and professor at Brown University who has explored the story of what he calls the wildly unsung 1949 discovery of lithium as a cure for bipolar disorder. He calls it one of the most important breakthroughs of the modern era, and he answers the questions surrounding why, discovered in 1949, lithium would not be available to patients until 1970. Meanwhile, those patients underwent horrifying treatments to cure bipolar disorder. Walter Brown tells the story in his new book, Lithium, A Doctor, A Drug, and A Breakthrough. I think we're still waiting to get Walter Brown on the phone, but he should be with us momentarily. Lynn, that segment we just had was interesting. I just don't understand why somebody would try that coffee. Just
I don't either. And I figured it wasn't wouldn't do any good to ask him exactly what it tasted like, because I'm sure you and I have never tasted anything that tastes quite like Civet coffee.
Yeah, I had heard about it before, but I just it's just. And now Walter Brown joins us, who has written Lithium, A Doctor, A Drug, and A Breakthrough. Walter, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Glad to hear.
Yeah, great to have you here. Before we talk about lithium, maybe you can take a couple of minutes and tell us about the treatment history for bipolar before lithium.
Well, before lithium came along, bipolar patients or people with manic depressive illness were treated the way all people with serious mental illness were treated. Starting in antiquity, people with serious mental illness underwent purging and bleeding, which didn't do much good and was sometimes dangerous. And by the Middle Ages, a number of other treatments were being used, and in particular, it was at that time that people started being put in asylums. Before the Middle Ages, there really weren't any asylums. Patients with serious mental illness were just cared for by their families or left to wander the streets. But it wasn't really until the 19th and early 20th centuries that specific treatments for mental illness came into play, and some of these included opium, which was used to sedate patients, bromides and barbiturates that was used to sedate patients to put them to sleep. And finally, in the early 20th century, a number of physical treatments that were more dangerous than anything else were widely applied. And these included fever therapy for tertiary syphilis or a general paralysis of the insane, which was a late-stage syphilis development that was very damaging to the brain. Deep sleep was a common treatment in the 1920s in which patients were given high doses of sedatives and put to sleep for a week or more. Then when they woke up, sometimes their serious mental symptoms were less apparent, but they really weren't fundamentally better, and manic depressive or bipolar patients were treated that way. In the 1930s, insulin coma was a very popular treatment in which people were given insulin. It dropped their blood sugar, and they went into a prolonged coma, which they only came out when they were given infusions of glucose. And again, this treatment was widely applied to the treatment of both schizophrenia and the severe depressive phase of manic depressive illness. But it was quite dangerous. People sometimes didn't come out of the coma. Sometimes they developed pneumonia while they were in it. And finally, the notorious lobotomy was discovered by a Portuguese neurologist named Moniz in the mid-30s, in which the frontal lobes were severed from the rest of the brain using what was essentially an ice pick through the orbit of the eye. And this treatment was supposedly useful in calming agitated patients, including some with manic depressive illness. But although it was widely used through the 1940s and 1950s, and in fact Moniz was given the Nobel Prize for this treatment development, it ended up having devastating side effects for people and wasn't all that useful. The best treatment that was around before Cade discovered lithium in 1949 was electroconvulsive treatment that was used primarily for severe depression, but also sometimes for mania. And it was brought online in about 1938 by by an Italian psychiatrist. But it, although it could bring people out of depression and bring them out of a manic episode, its effects were only temporary, and it came with some nasty side effects and consequences as it was used early on, including broken bones. So there really wasn't much that was useful before the discovery of lithium and other drugs.
And haven't they augmented or modified or tried other approaches in the electric convulsive type strategies?
Absolutely. Electric convulsive treatment is still used, and different from the way it was used when it first was applied in the late 1930s and 1940s, now people are given anesthesia with it and also chemicals that reduce the actual intensity of the convulsions so that people no longer have problems with broken bones and dislocated bones, etc., because they're really not having a severe convulsion anymore. So it's really quite a, it's one of the safest treatments and one of the most effective treatments in psychiatry. But again, sometimes the results are temporary and it doesn't do anything really to prevent the episodes of mania and depression, as does lithium.
And Dr. Brown, is that akin to resetting a computer, rebooting a computer?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
When the electric convulsive therapies are used, is that like doing a reset?
I haven't ever thought of it that way or heard it described that way. The fact is that we really don't know why electroconvulsive therapy works. The idea of rebooting is an intriguing one to me, and I'll have to give that some thought.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Walter Brown. His new book is Lithium, A Doctor, A Drug, and A Breakthrough. And Walter, I just wanted to say, you mentioned it briefly in your book, but of course, as you talk about an ice pick through the eye and into the frontal lobes of the brain, the lobotomy, it seems so violent. Well, it is so violent.
Doesn't seem calming.
And so ineffective. But of course, it was a recent, I think, a podcast or something I heard, the whole story about Rosemary Kennedy, the
right.
eldest daughter of Joe Kennedy, and he allowed her to go through a lobotomy, resulting in her being a two-year-old the rest of her life. And she lived a long life. I mean, I think it was in 1940 that she was lobotomized, and she didn't die until 2005 or something. Yet another tragedy of the Kennedy family. But you think about now someone with the same symptoms that Rosemary Kennedy had being helped to such a huge degree that you may not even notice or know someone has bipolar disorder unless you know them very, very well and know their medical history. So this is where the conversation goes to lithium. And a professor in a little lab that was unsponsored by, again, Big Pharma,
that's
the culprit, right, of many of the drugs that are on the market. Go into that, the scientist Cade from Australia.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reasons that I was drawn to this story. You know, the National Institutes, National Institute of Mental Health has spent trillions of dollars, I believe that's not an exaggeration, on researching new treatments in psychiatry with very, very little to show for it. We really don't have any new treatments, things that are work differently or better, in the last 60 years, since this the first psychiatric drugs were discovered between Cage's discovery in 1949 and the 1960s. We just don't have, we have new drugs, but they really don't represent an improvement over the old ones. But yet Cade, working in isolation in a remote psychiatric hospital outside of Melbourne, Australia, with no research funds, no grant, no collaborators, and no formal research training, came up with what is arguably the most important, if not one of the most important, treatment discoveries in psychiatry. And what this book is about is how he sort of managed to do this, which has to do with his innate curiosity, his ability to perceive and act on unexpected observations, and his persistence.
And so how did he test and find that lithium worked on patients with bipolar disorder?
Well, what he was doing some experiments in guinea pigs in which he was trying to find out what caused manic depressive illness. And he was going about this by taking urine samples from patients in the hospital where he worked who had manic depressive illness and patients who had other conditions, and injecting this urine into guinea pigs to see if the urine from the manic depressive patients was in some ways more toxic. It was, in Cade's words, an extremely crude toxicity test. He basically tried to find out how much urine it took from one of these patients to kill a guinea pig. And if it took a relatively small amount of urine, that would suggest that there was some toxic substance in it. And in fact, some of the urine from manic depressive patients seemed to be more toxic, was more readily lethal to guinea pigs. And then Cade went about trying to discover what the substance in the urine was that was causing the death of the guinea pigs. And in the course of doing research into looking at these constituents, he started to inject these animals with uric acid, which is one of the constituents of urine. And uric acid is not readily soluble, but when you combine it with lithium into a salt called lithium urate, it becomes soluble, and he was able to inject lithium urate and other lithium compounds into guinea pigs. And when he did this, he did find that the toxicity of the urine was less, but that the guinea pigs became tranquilized. And the fact that these animals were tranquil but not asleep gave him the idea that it may be useful in manic patients. And he went next door to a ward which had manic patients and started treating them with lithium. After, I might add, he tried some lithium on himself.
Yeah, fascinating. Dr. Brown, why was lithium stigmatized for so long?
Well, one of the reasons is that lithium is a potentially toxic or poisonous substance. And that was known about from the 19th century on when lithium was used to treat all kinds of medical conditions. But the real problem with it and what put people off was that in 1949, the same year that Cade published his paper, lithium was tried as a salt substitute for people with high blood pressure, or kidney disease that were on low-salt diets. It was discovered that lithium chloride, one of the salts of lithium, is in fact have a salty taste. And so it was used as a substitute for ordinary table salt, sodium chloride. People in this country, and this was limited to the United States, started using it very liberally on their food and took too much. And a number of patients died as a result of lithium poisoning from its use as a salt substitute. And the FDA and the medical establishment became very concerned about lithium and removed it in all of its forms from pharmacy and hospital shelves. And that salt substitute panic, actually, stayed in the memories of people for a long time and really was part of the reason that it took a long time for lithium to be approved in this country.
Okay. The scientific process is basically the same as it's been for a while, but there have been some changes. And in the 40s, when Cade published his study, it was a small study, and it probably would not be recognized today in the way that
that's correct.
Peer-reviewed larger studies occur. And you know, I'm just curious. He was a different person than your traditional researchers, and I'm curious because he has a process which is sort of ignored in science today. Are there other people out there like Cade who are onto something but who are not getting any recognition? You know, you think about other Cades out there. What do you think about that?
I think there probably are. I think that somebody who is kind of creative and an unconventional thinker might be able to put together a grant with some help, but they also, you know, might not have the patience to do it. The kind of a person who can write a successful grant application and get their research funded is not necessarily the same kind of person who is going to make a creative leap as a scientist. Although, you know, certainly there are people who are successful grant writers who are very, very creative scientists. They don't always go together. So I think there probably are people out there who just would never even attempt to get the kind of funding and resources that you need in order to do this sort of highly technological, expensive research that is done today.
Walter, as we've talked about, lithium has been around for a long time. One of the first three elements was something that I learned from your book. Very interesting. And because it is found, it's naturally occurring in nature, it can't be patented, which is a huge reason, as you say, that from its discovery is helping bipolar those with bipolar disorder in 1949. It wasn't available until 1970. Big Pharma is to blame for that. I'm wondering what now is the case with lithium, and no doubt that Big Pharma went to develop other something that could take the place of lithium that would be patentable. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You're asking me what sort of is the place of lithium now?
Exactly.
Yes. It's still alone among the first generation of psychiatric drugs developed in the mid-20th century. Alone among them, it is still widely used. It's still, I think, safe to say, the gold standard treatment for the prevention of manic and depressive episodes. It's still widely used. It now has some competitors. Valproate would be first among them, another drug that can prevent manic and depressive episodes. But lithium has certain advantages over it. Lithium is enjoying, actually, something of a renaissance now, as very systematic studies have consistently shown that it reduces suicide in manic depressive patients more so than other drugs used to treat that condition, much more so. So although we still don't know how lithium works to prevent manic and depressive episodes, it's clear that in the majority of patients with this condition, it does so. And as long as people are carefully monitored with respect to their blood levels of lithium, it's quite a safe treatment. There's also some evidence that lithium may be useful in one or two other conditions, most intriguingly in preventing or treating dementia. There's some evidence that when people who are bipolar take lithium, their risk for dementia is lower than if they don't.
Very interesting. We've got just about a minute left, but I do want to leave with this question, which is, if we don't really know how lithium works, how do we develop a synthetic alternative like valproate and have it be able to target the certain effect?
Yeah, that's a very, very fundamental question. It's extremely difficult to come up with new treatments when there is not a clear understanding of what the target of that treatment is going to be. That is, what the underlying disease process is. And in fact, you know, it's true, we don't know exactly how lithium works. So right now, the route to drug development is more of a trial and error approach than something which I'd say can follow a more logical path.
The book is titled Lithium, A Doctor, A Drug, and A Breakthrough, written by Walter Brown. Walter, thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. So many things about lithium I did not know. I mean, I admit, my knowledge was very small to begin with, so the learning curve quite steep, but pretty phenomenal.
If you ask people, you know, what are the breakthroughs in the last century, they'll say penicillin, the X-ray, maybe insulin, maybe the DNA double helix, but no one ever says lithium.
That's right.
And lithium's big time.
Well, and I think it's because, as you say, it was stigmatized as something that, you know, that killed people when they used it as table salt. Can you imagine using it as table salt?
I can. No, I'm only kidding.
And then you take a nap, right?
And then you take a nap.
Oh. It's Cool Science Radio. You're listening to KPCW Park City.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. If you missed part of the show or you want to share it, all our shows are posted within the hour on kpcw.org under the Shows tab.
We also podcast all of KPCW's Public Affair Hour shows wherever you find your podcasts, so you can find them under KPCW and the individual show name.
So look for KPCW Cool Science Radio and take us with you on your next road trip or commute.